Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, though.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, where we talk to the legends of bodybuilding and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. I'm your host, John Hansen. On this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, we're going to be talking to Mr. Steve Brisbois. Steve was a professional bodybuilder in the 1980s and early 1990s. He got his pro card by winning the bantamweight class at the 1986 IFBB World Championships, which was the first world championships where they did drug testing. And Steve also won the Canadian championships that same year as a lightweight competitor. And he was the only lightweight to ever win an overall at a national championship in any country. So that was really historic. So we're going to talk to Steve Brisbois in a minute. And we're going to have two parts to this interview. We'll have part two next week. But on this part of the interview, Steve's going to talk about how he got into bodybuilding and his Canadian championship win and also his win at the world championships. And then when he started competing in the professional division, which a lot of people discouraged Steve from competing in the pros because at only 5'4" and as a lightweight, a lot of people thought, of course, he wouldn't have any chance, but he did very well. So it was a really interesting interview. We cover a lot of topics. So we will hear from Steve Brisbois in a minute. Before we get to that, I want to mention our sponsor, who is Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. They have a certified and knowledgeable staff that will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. So call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, 813-922-8939, or you can just go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. Again, that's flalternativemeds.com. They have offices all over the United States, but they can work with anybody in the continental United States just through their website. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they'll give you a free consultation. Plus, they'll give you 20% off your first order. All right. So how's everybody out there doing? Christmas is 1 week away, if you can believe it. Man, this year flew by, and we are now at the end of 2022. So I hope everybody is ready for Christmas. I will be going out of town to Chicago, where I'm from, where my family is. And going out there on the 23rd, right before Christmas, and I'll be out there for about a week. So hopefully we will have part two of our show next week, and then hopefully we'll get another show up the week after Christmas, which will be like the 27th, 28th. Don't want you guys to miss a show anymore. And we did get some emails. I've been asking for emails, and I finally got some emails last week from last week's show, so I want to read those in a second. Also, I've been dieting. I mentioned that before on the show. I've probably been dieting like 4 months now, and we are getting down to crunch time. I made a photo shoot for myself. I scheduled a photo shoot on the 20th, which will be next Monday. So I'm getting really close to where I wanted to look. I just kind of did this for myself, and of course, I'm doing the online training now with Pro Physique. So if you guys are interested in hiring me as an online coach for your nutrition or training, you can just go to prophysique.com and request me as a coach. So I thought it would be a good idea to take some pictures since I've gone through all this dieting. And 1 week to go, I decided to do 3 days of low carbs and 1 day of high carbs. So today is day number 3 of the first time I'm doing the low carbs. So it's pretty tough. I'm kind of lightheaded. And so hopefully I can get through this podcast without passing out. But tomorrow is my high carb day. And then I'm going to see what I look like the day after high carbs. And then I'm going to do it one more time. I'll do 3 more days of low carbs, 1 more day of high carbs, and then the photo shoot will be the day after that on Monday the 20th. So I'll let you guys know how that went next week when we talk. If you're on my Facebook page or my Instagram page,
I've been posting some pictures up occasionally, so you can check those out. And I'll be sure to post up some pictures from the photo shoot as well. So check that out if you're following me on social media. When we get done with our interview with Steve Brisbois, part one, I'm going to read an article from, this is the August 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness, and it's another article by Frank Zane. So this was the article that Frank wrote before the 1980 Mr. Olympia, before he knew Arnold Schwarzenegger was going in it. And I believe this was also before he had his accident at the pool. This should be a really interesting article. Frank sounds very positive in this article. It sounds like things were really going well for him. His weight was up. His training was going really good. And he even said he had his dream, his prophetic dream that he always had before every Mr. Olympia win. So that would be interesting to see what that dream was, because, of course, we know Frank ended up in third place that year behind Arnold and Chris Dickerson. So this should be an interesting article. So I will read that for you guys as soon as we get done with our interview with Steve Brisbois. I hope you guys enjoyed that article I read last week about the 1970 Mr. Olympia. I thought that was really interesting by Rick Wayne from Muscle Builder magazine. It was really a long article. I think it took me 40 minutes to read it, but if you hadn't had a chance to check that out, go check that out. Also, I did put on my YouTube page the 1969 Mr. Olympia, part of our bodybuilding history series. I haven't done one of these in probably like 8 months. So I finally got one back up. This is the 1969 Olympia between Arnold and Sergio. This was the first time they ever met. And Sergio beat Arnold this contest. And this was Sergio's third Mr. Olympia contest. And they also had the IFBB Mr. America and Mr. Universe that night. Arnold won the Universe, beating out Franco and Rick Wayne. And he also won most of the body parts. And John DeCola, who we've had on the show before. We've had him on the podcast a couple times for two parts of an interview. And John won the 1969 IFBB Mr. America. That was his biggest title to date. And then John stopped competing for a while after that because he was a natural bodybuilder and he knew he could not compete against the guys using steroids. He said that was the year in 1969 when he really saw the use of steroids being accelerated by the competitors. So if you haven't had a chance to listen to that interview with John DeCola, he was very entertaining. Just go on to the bodybuildinglegendshow.com website and look under the podcast link, and you'll be able to find that. All right. So let me get to some of these emails here. I appreciate you guys emailing me. I was a little lonely without any emails for a while, so we finally got some. If anybody out there wants to email me about the show, just go to naturalolympia@gmail.com, and you can email me there. All right. This first one is from Chris Rasney. Chris is a longtime listener of the show. He said, John, your interview with Rick Newcomb was one of your best. I just ordered his book as a Christmas present to myself. Are you able to share his contact info? As a fellow native Chicagoan, I would love to get in touch with him. All the best to you and have a happy holiday season. And this one was from Mark Martinez, and Mark's new movie called Dream Big, which was a documentary about the history of Gold's Gym and the Venice Beach area in the 1970s. It is now being released at film festivals in the California area. And I think Mark even won an award at one of the festivals. I was hoping to get out there to see one, but I just was not able to do it with the new job and everything. So I'm glad it's going well for Mark. It seems like the film is being very well received. So I can't wait till that is released on some kind of streaming network, hopefully, or even maybe in the movies. That would be awesome. So I will keep you guys up to date on that. Anyways, Mark writes, hi, John. It was great listening to the last two podcasts. I have a personal connection to both Ed Connors and Rick Newcomb. Both were gracious enough to come out to view my film at the Culver City Film Festival on December 5th in person. I met Rick's wife, and she's very sweet, and Rick is the consummate gentleman. Ed and I catch up occasionally when he's in the Bay Area. I'm looking forward to the completion of his book. I have been fortunate enough to have read a draft version of it. Oh, wow. That's cool. I wish I could read that. And then Mark says, on the history of the Gold's ownership, with you and I being historians of bodybuilding, the accuracy is important, if just for history nerds such as myself. Joe Gold owned Gold's from 1965 to 1970. He sold it to Bud Danitz and Dave Sachs. They sold Gold's to Ken Sprague in early 1972. Ken owned it from 1972 to 1979. During that time frame, Pumping Iron, the book, was written, and then a year later, the film was shot there. Ken made it easy for Butler and Fiore by installing a lighting grid overhead and blocking out the front windows to eliminate backlight issues that would have made things difficult for the 16mm film camera used by White Mountain Productions. In late 1979, with Ken's wife Marion passing away to a very aggressive form of cancer, he decided to sell Golds. It was Marion who told Ken that Pete Kremkowski, a friend of theirs, was the best person to maintain the legacy of the gym, what with Pete being a top-level bodybuilder and a natural entrepreneur. Pete recruited friend Ed Connors, an architect with a degree from UC Berkeley, and Tim Kimber, a bodybuilder from Pete's hometown of Rochester, New York. Ken had a few other offers, one from a group who offered more than 10 times the purchase price of the gym and threatened Ken with a lawsuit if he did not sell it to them, which was a baseless threat. Pete, Ed, and Tim took what was established and they took it to another level. So many things had to happen for Golds and the exposure and growth of bodybuilding to happen that most of the current crop have no idea of. Keep up the good work, John. Mark Martinez. Wow, that was a great email by Mark, and it really does spell out the history of the ownership of Gold's Gym. So that was great. Thank you, Mark, and good luck with your film. And then I did also got a review on Apple Podcasts. If you listen to our Bodybuilding Legends podcast on Apple, you can go to the Apple website and leave a review there. This one came from the UK, from the United Kingdom. It's a great podcast with Tim Kimber and Ed Connors. It really portrayed the atmosphere from one of the most important times in bodybuilding. I love the story of Grimco on the Doors. What a sight that must have been. Great stuff, John. I love your show so much. Thanks for all the fantastic stories. We're honored if you'd have told me when I was 13 years old in 1977 that I'd be able to listen to my idols as your guests years later. I never would have thought it possible. Thanks very much, Rob Beardsmore from the United Kingdom. All right. Thank you, Rob. Love hearing from our listeners from overseas. That's awesome. All right. Without any further ado, guys, here is our interview, part one of our interview with Steve Brisbois, the 1986 Bantamweight World Champion and also a pro bodybuilder. Here we go. All right. Welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I have a very special guest with me this week, Mr. Steve Brisbois, who is a pro bodybuilder in the 1990s. So we're going to talk to Steve about his career. How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing fantastic, John. Thanks for having me on, man. It's such a pleasure.
My pleasure having you on. So, Steve, we always start at the beginning. Why don't you give us some background on when you started lifting weights and what made you decide to become a bodybuilder?
So, I started weight training in 1982.
Okay.
I come from a small mining town up in Canada. It's actually happens to be one of the largest gold mining municipalities in the entire world. People don't know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's, you know, half the town works in the gold mines and the mines up there, man. And
okay.
Ore and nickel and gold and stuff like that. But
is it still like that, Steve?
Sorry?
Is it still like that? Still a lot of mining? Oh, really?
Yep. Wow. It's big. Mining's big in my hometown.
Wow.
A lot of people still work there. They have, at the time, they had the largest open pit in the world when I left.
Holy cow.
And, but you know, it was a party town. I grew up partying, drinking, doing drugs and the whole nine yards. And, you know, I got into a little bit of trouble here and there. And, I was 20, whatever age I was at 82, 20 something years old, I think 22. I had enough or something happened. I went to the gym one day with a friend of mine. He was going there. You know, I messed around in high school, wrestling and stuff like that, man. Nothing serious.
Yeah.
Well, I went to the gym and had my first workout ever that was isolated workout with, we did bench, we did chest.
Yeah.
You know, not knowing anything about how the body works for that. So we did, you know, chest and all that stuff, man. I was there probably for about an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
The next day when I woke up, I said, okay, something is not right. I had a soreness I've never had in my life.
Right.
And it hit me right away that, wow, this is something is unique here. I was absolutely amazed on what I felt.
Yeah.
And for me, it was a turning point because I went back the next day. When I woke up that morning and I felt that way, I said, okay, I'm going back. And I did. And when I went back, there was some guys in there. It was a really hardcore powerlifting gym in my hometown. And then I had some of the guys show me some things, and I ended up doing buys and tries or something that day. And of course, the next day, the same thing. I had this soreness. I'm like, what? I think, what am I doing? Am I stupid or what?
Right.
But I ended up going to the store and buying all these magazines and reading things and realized, wow, man. So I was nonstop. Nonstop. But
did you know anything about bodybuilding before that?
Sorry?
Did you know anything about bodybuilding before that?
Not a thing.
Okay.
All I knew was Johnny Atlas kicking sand or punches.
Right.
Old sand cover or in the magazines, whatever.
Yeah.
It was 9 months after I started, John. I entered my first contest at a bunch of my friends in the gym said, "Come on, Steve, let's go to Toronto." Man, Toronto's 500 miles north of my hometown.
Uh-huh.
I said, "I'm having fun," it was about 6 weeks prior to the contest, and I was already looking in pretty good shape. I'm like, I adapted really quick. Keeping in mind that when I was 14, 15, and 16, I was a competitive diver and swimmer. I was the Northern Ontario diving, springboard diving champion in
Olympics.
And so I had some athletic background. I played hockey. I was pretty good at it for a while, man, but I was too short to get into the boards with some of these guys, man. But I was 6 weeks away from the contest, and I said, man, so I just looked at everything in the magazines and dialed down. And I'll never forget what my dad said to me one day, because here I am in the middle of the living room. I take the mirror off the wall, and I put the mirror in the right place in the living room so I can pose in it.
Yeah.
And my dad's looking at me, and, you know, I've disappointed him many times in my life. And he goes, you know, it was kind of a little funny comment about, you know, doing something, you know, again, you know, just to waste your time or whatever. I forget how he said it, but it wasn't really insulting to me because I think he thought I was just doing nothing.
Yeah.
So when I ended up preparing for the contest, went to the show, and had to be 2,000 people in the audience in Toronto. It was my first contest. I was nervous and I'll get out, man. And just walked on stage and I won. I said, holy.
You won. Wow.
What the hell's going on? It's unbelievable. So from that point, I ended up competing a couple more times that year, and that was 1983.
Okay.
And then 84 came along, and from that point in 84, I climbed the ladder in Canada, and I was like this up-and-coming bodybuilder. And then all of a sudden in 84, I qualified for the Canadian Championships in 85, and then I went to the Canadian Championships.
Wow.
And this whole time, I was completely drug free.
Yeah. And now, did you respond pretty quickly, Steve? Did your body grow pretty fast?
Absolutely. I was amazed at, because I had people in my hometown look at me walking around town here and there. Everybody knows everybody, right? And I would have some feedback coming to me about, "Hey, Steve, I heard all these guys talking about you, man. What the hell's going on here?" And they look at me, say, "Wow, look at what are you doing, man? You're looking amazing. I can't believe the size you're putting on." And it was
wow.
Great compliment, right? And I just, in the Canadian Championships in 85, I was the up and coming new bodybuilder of the country. And I had a lot of fans at the time, which I'm like, oh man, this is pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So I lose the lightweight division by 1 point.
Wow.
I'm like, okay, I was disappointed because I thought the only thing I wanted to do was go to the universe.
Yeah.
And the story behind that, John, is in 85 was the first time I had ever taken a dose of steroids.
Okay.
And I took them for about 3 to 4 weeks. And I did not like what they did. I felt I didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
And I just took some. I got off it 2 weeks before the contest or something. I didn't like this stuff. I still thought I was decent, but I could tell that I was I wasn't as hard as I should have been.
So it was holding water?
I was holding, and I realized that, you know, the steroids did a little bit of it, but I still thought I was in good shape to win the contest. But at the athletes meeting before the contest, the Canadian promoter comes up to us and says, he sits all the athletes down and says, "Look, next year we're taking a team to the Tokyo Mr. Universe, and it's going to be the first drug-tested Mr. Universe ever in Tokyo, Japan in 1986. So he said that we're taking a natural bodybuilding team, and then anybody that's going to want to go, you're going to have to sign an affidavit because we want you to complete the drug-free, because you're going to be tested. If you're caught with drugs, you're going to have a big fine.
Hmm.
So I'm thinking, okay. I start talking to all the guys after the Canadian Championships was gone next year, and I go to find out that most of these guys, all they care about is just winning the Canadian Championships, and they were going to stick onto their steroids.
Oh, they didn't care about World Championships.
Sorry?
They didn't care about going to the World Championships. They just wanted to go to the Canadian.
It was very odd to me at the time because I thought they thought that maybe they could get away with it or something, and they didn't realize it was serious. But so I ended up training the entire year, just balls to the walls. I put my head in the dirt, and I was so focused, man. And the one thing I did not do is I did not step in a scale throughout this whole time.
Okay.
And I weighed 154 in 1985 Lightweight Championships in Canada, which is 154 and under.
Yeah.
So I did 154. So I ended up going to Vancouver a year later, and come time for weighing, and I was shredded, John. I was so shredded. I thought, wow, man. I the only thing I thought about, I don't care if I win. It didn't matter to me. I want to go to the universe, man. That was my goal.
Yeah.
And we're all preparing backstage and stuff like that. Well, I'm waiting, I should say. I'm going for the weigh-in. And the actual guy who was promoting the show at the time was named Calvin Naiuli. He actually placed third to me the year prior in the Canadian Championships.
And who won in 85, Steve? Was that Jean LeBlanc?
No, Ray Bollier.
Ray Bollier, okay. Yeah. Lightweight.
And he was my roommate. And I'll tell you what happened to him.
Okay.
So we get there, and I decide to we're in the weigh-in, and I'm weighing in, and I step on a scale, and I look down, and I said, "You gotta be kidding me." My shape was like, I loved how I looked. I was in phenomenal shape, and I'm looking down. It's okay. Something's not right here. I weighed in 143 pounds.
Wow.
I'm like 10 pounds lighter. And I said, God, I was almost devastated. And Calvin said, Steve, that's fantastic. You can go bantamweight.
Yeah.
And I said, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going lightweight because I want to go to the champ. I lost the last year by a point. I'm going lightweight. And realizing that I didn't care if I won, I wanted to go back to lightweight.
Yeah.
I hop in a lightweight class at 143 pounds.
Well, they let you go lightweight at 143?
I could have gone heavyweight if I wanted to. So he didn't have a choice. He goes, Steve, you're crazy giving up that kind of weight. I said, I don't care, Calvin. I'm going to compete in lightweight.
Okay.
So lo and behold, bantamweights go on stage, then lightweights go on, and I think you're going to appreciate this, John. It's I get on stage and we all come out the one at a time to see the judges looking at us, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know how that goes. Each bodybuilder does their pose and then back in line. And now they take all the comparisons. I stood there, never got compared one time. Not once. I was devastated. I'm thinking, okay, not only did I not get compared, they're not going to pick me for the universe. I mean, I thought I was going to cry on stage. I really thought I was going to break down. I said, I didn't know what's going on.
Right.
So we're done. I go backstage and I'm sitting on this chair. My head's down, man. I'm feeling so deflated. Like, what the hell happened? And I got a buddy who comes backstage. He looks at me. He sees me sitting down. He goes, hey, he shakes me, Steve, what the hell's wrong with you? I said, did you see what happened? He goes, yeah. I said, they didn't call me out. He goes, they didn't need to. I said, hang on. This is unheard of. What are you talking about, man? He said, they didn't need to call me up, man. They were just judging second on down. I said, you got to be kidding me.
Wow. He said,
let's go. It was amazing because we went to the, you know, as you go on the audience after, people start congratulating you.
Right.
You
know, right.
You haven't won yet.
Right.
And I'm shaking hands with people. That are like, I'm at that point, I said, wow, I might win this.
Yeah.
So lo and behold, they win the lightweight division in a bad weight. And, so I'm like, all right, I'm going to the universe. Like that was the biggest moment of my life to know that. But what happened after that is so now, as you know, they have the overall championships, right?
Right.
So we're all on stage and I'm just having a good time up there, man. I'm already going to the universe, man. I'm just out there just having a good time, packed with people in the audience, man. And so all of a sudden, the promoter goes, okay, ladies and gentlemen, what a fantastic big night for this gentleman. The overall Canadian champion in 1986 is Steve. Unbeknownst to me, which I forgot, the heavyweight guy was named Steve. So he started jumping up and down.
Oh, no. And
I clapped my hands for him looking over because I'm like, good for him, man.
Yeah.
And he called my last name out.
Yeah.
And when he called my last name, I was absolutely shocked. And the audience went berserk.
Wow, that's shit.
Okay, the ceiling came off, man. I couldn't believe what just happened.
Yeah. And that was the first time a lightweight ever won the Canadian championships.
It was to be honest with you, John, in the history of the world, I'm the only bodybuilder at a bantamweight weight to ever win their overall national championship.
Yeah. Holy shit. Unbelievable.
So it was a milestone for me.
It hasn't happened in any other country.
Never. I looked and looked and looked all these years. One bantamweight. I couldn't even find a lightweight who won the overall championship.
Yeah. I couldn't think of a lightweight either. Yeah.
But it was amazing, but
yeah.
It was fun. So we fly 3 days later to Tokyo, and I'm on stage with, I don't know, 20 guys maybe. Now, this time here, I drop down.
Okay.
Because this is international, right?
Yeah.
I can drop down to the bantamweight division, and I'm on stage with all these guys. And I kid you not, John, I was called up, I think it was 12 times in a row.
Hmm.
Every single judge from whatever country they came from called their guy, some other guy, and me. Always me and two other guys. I'm like, holy. So there was one time, I think about that 12th time, I'm walking on stage and I'm looking like this, and I look at the judge and he goes, puts his hand and says, okay. He knew I had enough, man.
Yeah, right.
So anyway, I won that, and that was October 86.
Yeah. How did that feel, Steve?
I still think of those memories and what I went through being there and all that, yeah. Being in Tokyo. And it was an amazing, amazing feeling, man. And, you know, I thought, okay, this is great, man. I've got some things going on in this sport. I'm going to think about doing something. So when I get back to Canada and all that, I was really good friends with Robert Kennedy. I don't know if you remember him.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Muscle Mag. He was only 10 minutes from where I lived. And I used to go see him all the time, man. He was such an awesome gentleman, man. And
yeah,
Steve Douglas was the photographer, was a good friend of mine, took a lot of pictures for me and all that. But when I came back and did all these photo shoots with Robert Kennedy in a magazine and all that, within like weeks, and first thing he said was, hey, Steve, you got to go pro. I said, yeah, you think? He goes, yep. He goes, you got what it takes, man. He goes, I know you're light now, but put some mass on, go pro.
Yeah.
But now when he said that, John, you know exactly what I had to do, right?
Drugs, yeah.
Yeah, and I didn't hesitate at this time. I talked to many people. I had done my research.
Yeah.
I knew there was a little bit of something that was going to scare me a bit. Now, before I go there, before turning pro, let me back up to what happened with this, a point I forgot when bodybuilding. See, when I was in my early 20s, before I went to the gym and became a bodybuilder, I actually had a kidney disease.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it was another indication for me to do something different in my life, or just something that happened to me. And I'll never forget that because it stuck with me for a long time. And I had to go to the special hospital in Toronto on my 19th birthday and found out I had a disease called glomerular nephritis.
Okay.
And basically it's a blood vessels in the kidneys that would burst open no matter what. Nobody knew what it was. But years later, I go to find out it had everything to do with diet. And I was on a very horrible, horrible eating plan before I got into bodybuilding in my hometown. I ate massive amounts of those terrible prepared luncheon meats with all those little things inside of it. Man,
right.
We grew up on that stuff, fried bologna,
milk
by the gallons every day. And years later, I go to find out one of the reasons I had that disease is because there's a concentrated source of unnatural protein going into my blood and my kidneys couldn't take it. And so that was a real excellent milestone for me to discover that. It got me on my path even more as a nutritionist, a self-taught nutritionist.
Yeah.
I teach a lot of people that.
How old were you, Steve, when you got this?
I was 19. Well, I had it when I was just coming out of high school at 18.
Okay.
And And I basically, what was going on, John, I was to go to the bathroom and I'd urinate pure blood all the time.
Mm, wow.
And it's gone for about 2 years. And I never said anything to my mom.
Oh, shit. Wow.
Finally said something to her living at home because she worked for a doctor and we had these tests done and went to Toronto and all this stuff. But I'll never forget the day that I think it was right before I went in the gym for the first time with my good friend. And his name was Wayne, man. Still a friend of mine to this day.
Okay.
And I went up to my mom probably weeks before that. And I had these antibiotics and I said, hey, mom, I'm not taking these ever again. And she goes, well, you're going to have to because you might have some problems with the kid. I said, nope. I said, I'm going to throw these out and I'm going to start learning how to eat right. Not knowing 2 weeks later or so, I was going to the gym with my friend.
Hmm. Wow.
And I dug into some health and nutrition at the time. And then I got into bodybuilding.
Okay.
So I never had a recurring bout with that. I was good on it. I felt very confident. And then when I was ready after the universe to go pro and take the drugs, one of the things that a lot of guys don't do when they take these steroids is they don't even look at all the paperwork. And I did.
Yeah.
And one of the contraindications on all the steroids that you take today is contraindications, glomerular nephritis, which is something I had.
Right.
And I was a little afraid, but I realized my diet was good. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to go crazy. And I didn't. I took small doses, but I went from October 86 to May of 1987 to the Night of Champions. I went from 143 to 165 pounds, John.
20 pounds. Wow.
And like from October to May.
Yeah. Wow.
And that was my first pro show where I ended up placing ninth.
Okay.
And we're talking all the stars were there, man. Night of Champions, Wayne D'Amelio's show. And I'm on stage with all these guys. And the magazines come out later on and they say the next giant killer. It's like, wow.
Oh, really? Man. Wow.
So that's how I kind of got going with that. And so from that point on, I went to the
How did that feel going to the Night of the Champions, Steve?
It was awesome. It was – I wish I would have prepared the same way for the Olympia, but I didn't because I went to the Olympia that year too because don't forget Mr. Universe.
Automatically gets an invite, right?
Yeah, and I ended up doing dead last. What was that? There was a drug out. It was, I forget what it was called, Acicline or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And I put it on my shoulders and they swelled. And you can tell in the 87 Olympia how I looked and I could tell my shoulder, they weren't separated here. So I made a mistake, but
The judges marked you down for that?
Sorry?
The judges marked you down for that because they could see your
And although I thought I was decent shape, I wasn't shape enough to compete against these guys. I saw that and I realized it. Well, yeah. What I could say is in the Night of Champions, I was way better. I knew what I did then, and I kind of switched some things, thinking, the Olympia is a bigger show, but knowing that there was a lot of the same guys there, and I could have done the same thing. But
I
made that mistake, which was fine. But lo and behold, over the next couple of years, I started, making a name for myself, and then I got invited to the Arnold Classic in 1990. Where I placed fifth.
That first Night of the Champions, I got the list here. That was the one Gary Stridham won in 87.
Yeah. Oh, awesome gentleman, by the way, man. I remember I was standing there when I was there, John, backstage, and a lot of these guys come in. I'll never forget. Gary Stridham was one of the first guys to come and greet me. Shane DeMora.
Yeah.
He came over, and he was really super greeting me. Really nice. I felt like the guys then, it's like, oh, man, family, right?
Yeah.
There's a few other guys. I forget who was who, but it was a great feeling, man, to meet these guys backstage and stuff. Oh, and the story for the Night of Champions, John, was that when I called Wayne D'Amelio to let him know, look, I want to turn pro after the Mr. Universe, and he says, Steve, I think you're making a mistake because you're going to give away a lot of weight. I said, well, I basically have that decision, right? He goes, yeah. I said, okay. He goes, well, I just want you to know, man, it's you can have a tough time at it at your size. He said, all right.
Yeah.
So it was like almost like a little dig. I don't know that way because Wayne D'Amelio is a great guy, man.
Yeah.
But when I went to the Night of Champions, I actually saw him the week before in Toronto because there was a couples championship.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, I competed in that with Erica Mess.
Right. You weren't planning to do that, right?
No, she just needed a partner. I went in. We ended up doing, fifth or sixth together, but she wasn't really in the right shape. And it was okay. It didn't matter.
So were you just going to you were just going to see it, and she was there, and she needed a partner?
Well, they all came to our gym, everybody that trained.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know, Gold's Gym was the biggest gym in town. It was close to the and everything, so all the girls were coming in, and all of a sudden they knew me, and they said, hey, look, Steve, Erica wants you to compete with her. I said, sure. And then I saw Wayne at the show. Wayne goes, hey, Steve, good for you, man. I see you're eating a lot of chicken.
Now, Erica was from Holland, right?
What's that?
Erica was from Holland, right?
Yep.
Okay. So how did that go doing the couples? Did you guys have enough time to get a routine together and stuff?
We put a routine together really fast.
Mm-hmm.
Keeping in mind that my posing, John, was and with all due respect to everybody else, I was a little more above people in a way that when I won the universe, one of the journalists said that my posing was one of the greatest in the world, if not the best ones in the world, even with the pros.
Wow.
So, and I still have that caption here, man. I sent the picture of that to Ian and Big Naz not too long ago about that, man.
Uh-huh. How did you learn to pose?
I just started. Oh, I used to watch Muhammad Makawi.
Oh, okay.
And I saw his graceful posing, and I incorporated a little bit of that style and put my own into it. And I ended up putting together our Canadian routine for the universe.
The team posing. Yeah.
Team pose. And we won that too.
Did you really? Wow. Yeah. No kidding.
Oh, and by the way, I forgot to tell you about Ray Bollier. Ray Bollier was my roommate at the time, and he got caught for the steroids at the universe.
Oh, okay. So he was a lightweight.
Yeah, he came in there and competed too.
So he got kicked. He got kicked out. He couldn't compete in the universe because he got caught with steroids.
He was gonna go lightweight. I was bantamweight, and he couldn't compete because he got caught, man. And it was kind of a tough situation for him, man. But
how did they do the testing, Steve, at the universe? Were they testing everybody, or was it just random?
Yeah, no. What we did is that's a good question. What we stood in the room. Each class went in this room. All the judges were on stage.
Okay.
And we all stood up and took our shirts off and kind of just walked up and walked back, something like that. And the judges, they couldn't do everybody. So the judges, in their eyes, were already seeing the best, right?
Oh, okay.
Top guy. So basically they picked out, okay, like top, I think there was five or six or seven guys in each category, maybe less.
And they tested them.
And what's his name was there? Goldman.
Bob Goldman, yeah.
Yeah, because he was part of that back in the day, man. And
so you guys weren't on stage. You were just in a room, and all the judges were there. And then you just had to take your shirts off or your posing trunks, and you walk in front of the judges, and then they picked out six guys.
Yeah. And they picked out the guys they thought that needed to be tested. And we did that, and then the testing came back like the next day, and then that's when they determined two guys that got caught. And Ray was one of them, so... that's what happened with all that stuff, man. But, you know, going pro and after that and competing and with all these guys in Night of Champions, you know, that was a whole different story after that, man.
What song did you pose to at the Night of Champions?
Gosh. That goes so many years ago, man.
There was one routine you did that was so good. It was such a good song. I can't think of the name of it now.
If I'm not mistaken, I don't know the song, but I'll never forget Mike Christian commenting in the audience. You know Mike Christian, right?
Yeah.
I hear him yell at me, man, because he was talking about my pose and how fantastic it was, man. It was kind of like it was interesting to hear.
Yeah.
I just had a knack for posing, and I just knew how to put it together. That's why when I see guys today and girls pose, it's like you got to put more into it, man.
Yeah.
Especially when I'm judging the show too, and I don't see the guys hold the poses enough. You can tell when people are not practicing, of course, right?
Yeah.
But no, I just had a real good knack for the pose and stuff in that, man, and I just loved just putting something together and moving to it and just flowing with the music and feeling, you know. And most guys today are like, boom, boom, boom,
oh, terrible, yeah.
There's no flow. There's nothing, man.
I was helping a guy with his routine, and I was trying to get him to pose to that song. Because I'm helping a few guys from the gym or like local guys, and they'll come to me. I think they're hearing that I can help people with routines, and I'm pretty good at it, you know, with posing. Because I was decent at posing too. I mean, way better than these guys are now. you know.
Oh, I don't doubt that.
Yeah. I mean, I know how to do the transitions and I know how to pick like the poses that they look good in. And I keep telling them, I'm like, you got to have good music. And I don't know why, but all these young guys today are picking songs that don't have any lyrics. It's just instrumental. And I'm like, man, it's not going to work. I'm telling you, it's so much better with lyrics, you know? And I tried to get this young kid at the gym who had a nice physique. He's a little guy. He's only like 150 pounds, but he's got a really good physique. He got good legs. And when he, you know, starts posing, he looks really good. He doesn't look small. And I tried to get him to pose to that song, you know, Black Velvet. And he wouldn't do it. He's like, no, I like this song. And I'm like, oh, and it was okay. I mean, he moved well in the routine, but it just didn't have the impact, you know?
That's good to hear though, man. I mean, it's true. I've been through that before with some people, man.
Yeah. Because when you have the lyrics, you can coordinate the poses to that.
Absolutely.
You can do like if it's a part of the song where it's like Whitney Houston is, you know, letting it out and you can
bring
your arms out like Vince Taylor used to do that. I mean, the crowd goes nuts, you know,
it's manipulating
the audience in a way, you know?
Absolutely, man. That's the way I love to do it, man. Hey, and I think you're well aware as I am, there's only a few guys back in the day, even today, I don't even know if there's that many, that used to be able to pose like that, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the rest of the guys, they just kind of went through the routine. It was decent in that, but I can remember back then, there was myself, Lee Labrada was good. Sean Ray tended to have some good routines here and there. Of course, Vince Taylor, he was good.
Yeah.
You know, I had to follow him in the Arnolds, which was a big mistake, man. Although I still placed fifth, but following him and listening to Arnold's comments, man, it's like, ooh, that hurt, but it's okay. Yeah. I still did
well. Right. So let me take you back to that night of the champions. I want to talk. So I'm going to read off the guys who beat you. Like Stridham got first. Mike Ashley was second. Ron Love was third. Natashak was fourth. Robbie was fifth. Shane DeMora was sixth. Bertel Fox was seventh. David Hawk was eighth. And then you got ninth. So you beat out Tom Terwilliger, Roy Callender, Sean Jenkins. You beat Tony Pearson, Frank Richards, Scott Wilson. So you beat some really good guys, some real
legendary. Yeah, those are big names. I was excited to be on stage. I was floored that I ended up placing ninth in that.
Yeah.
And then there was the next year, I think it was, where I placed sixth.
In the Night of the Champions?
Yeah, and I was 1 point away. I think Bob Parris took fifth.
Okay.
And I was 1 point away from getting, like, tying him or something like that, and which would have got me to the to the Olympia.
Okay.
That was in 91.
Oh, in 91?
Yes.
Okay.
I think it was 91 or was it 89? One or the other for Night of Champions, but I'll never forget that, man, because the magazines came out, talked about my placing in that, and I just missed the Olympia by 1 point or something like that, man.
Wow, okay. So after that Night of the Champions, you went to the Olympia and you didn't do good. You got last place. How did it feel doing an Olympia? That was in Sweden, right?
Yeah. Gothenburg. I enjoyed the time. I love the camaraderie. I love, you know, being around all the people and going through that. But what a lot of people don't know, John, is from that point after the Miss Olympia, we had the Grand Prix Tour, right?
Yeah. Did you do that?
And it was the transformation I made within those 3 weeks after the Olympia was amazing because there was a couple of guys came up to me. The judges had said some things because I ended up climbing up more and more and more.
Okay.
Because of all that.
Yeah.
And
but what happened? You just got harder as the Grand Prix?
I was very strict on the next couple of days and weeks as we're getting to each show, and I got tighter and tighter, harder and harder. I ended up coming up in some place. I forget where I placed them. You should have to go back and look at them.
Yeah.
Did pretty decent. I knew that I had what it took to make it. But
where were you getting your food from, Steve? I mean, because you guys are traveling, you're on the road, right? Every couple of days you were doing a show or something? Yeah.
Well, a lot of us would bring certain things, but then what happened was no matter – anytime we went somewhere on those tours, the restaurants, and there was always people catering to us, the hotels and that.
Okay.
They would have food ready for us. Some guys would bring, I remember one time John Natashak bringing a 50-pound bag of rice with him, man. It was a comical, to say the least, I tell you.
Well, it was funny back then before all the airline restrictions, you know, in the 80s. And
right? You couldn't bring that on a plane now, man.
I talked to Lee Labrada, and he told me when he went to the Universe, which was in Sweden also in 85, he had a whole suitcase full of gallons of water.
You're kidding me. Holy smokes.
And by the time he got there, he said all the gallons had exploded. The water was everywhere.
Of course, right up in the air like that, man.
Yeah, right.
They catered to us. They took care of us in all these places. Okay. There was one place we went to, and I think the head of the hotel or somebody went in and really got mad at the chef because the chef was bringing out potatoes to us that had salt on it.
Oh, okay.
And we kind of all said something, you know, no salt. And then he went in there and blasted him or something.
Yeah.
But,
Who won those Grand Prix? Was that Gaspari?
Gosh. I should go back and look at all this stuff, John, but there was a few guys.
I think the first one, Haney did it. I think that was in Germany. And Haney won, and Gaspari was second, and Labrada was third, just same as the Olympia.
Yeah.
And Haney dropped out after the first one, so I was thinking probably Gaspari won.
Yep. Yeah, I'm glad you asked it because I'm going to go back and look at the archives and see about those shows because I'm curious now.
Yeah.
Who was there? Times, man. But
so what happened in '88, Steve? You went into the Niagara Falls and then you did the Night of the Champions again, right? In '88.
Yes. Okay. So coming up to '88, there was a point where I had to struggle a lot.
Okay.
In bodybuilding because I don't know if you remember Ben Johnson.
Yeah. Sure.
So Ben Johnson and I were pretty good friends. We trained at Gold's Gym.
Okay.
And he's, you know, fastest runner in the world.
Yeah.
So Ben Johnson and I was getting in the gym, train. And I got to tell you, John, this guy's legs, Ben Johnson, he had bodybuilding legs.
Yeah.
They were massive. I mean, I used to watch this guy squat 400 pounds in Gold's Gym in the world's fastest runner.
Wow.
Blew me away.
Yeah.
So I'll never forget that because him and I were friends. And then, and believe it or not, we used to meet sometimes at the doctor's office. And everybody knows that story because Dr. Ostefan was our doctor. I met him through some guys, and Ben Johnson was part of that too.
Okay.
And we'd both be in the office. We'd go inside. It's like, okay, guys, come on in, Steve and Ben. We'd go there, lean over the desk. Bring our pants down, give us each a shot. Okay, guys, you're good.
Yeah.
You know, and then Ben gets caught that year, of course, as everybody knows.
Right.
And so confiscated the files for the doctor.
Oh, really? And okay.
When they confiscated those files, my name's in there.
So what did they do?
They came to my door, and it wasn't anything major to the point where anybody's getting arrested.
Yeah.
But basically, the RCMP was kind of in charge of the investigation or something. And I got a knock at my door one night and opened the door. And this guy said, Mr. Brisbane, I'm so-and-so with the RCMP. I said, okay, come on in.
What's the RCMP, Steve?
It's equivalent to, I guess, like an FBI down here, Royal Canadian Mounted.
Okay.
Right. Pretty elite group of guys. It's a very elite form of, like, I don't know, maybe FBI or something. Maybe, I don't know, something like that. But they were in charge of the investigation. He said, look, I need you to come downtown and give us a testimony on this whole thing with Dr. Ostefan and Ben Johnson. I said, and I was like a little nervous. Okay. He goes, nothing's going to happen. We just need to get your testimony.
Okay.
Sure. So I go downtown the next day and I gave my whole testimony about how I got my drugs and stuff. He said, well, that's interesting, Mr. Briswell, because the doctor said that you were supplying him with steroids. I said, you got to be kidding me. So I was like, I couldn't believe what was happening. I didn't even
know. The doctor said you were supplying the doctor with steroids?
They had to try to point fingers.
Wow.
So that fell pretty fast. They knew that wasn't true. But then they had that whole inquiry in Canada called the Dubin Inquiry. You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I remember. That was a big thing about that, yeah.
And there was, as far as I know, there was 70-something witnesses, and only two of us got up there and basically just let our hearts out and spoke the truth. And I was one of them. And so was Ben's coach, I think Charlie Francis.
Yeah.
And so,
so you, you really couldn't get in trouble for that, right, Steve? Because you were going to the doctor. Well, it's not like you were getting illegal drugs or you were delivering.
Well,
drugs, you
know? Yeah, I was getting to the doctor. So, but they were questioning me and asking me, you know, where'd you get your steroids from? I said, well, they knew I'd got them from Dr. Ostermeyer. Would you get them anywhere else? Can you get steroids anywhere else? I said, yeah, I suppose you could. And the guy was questioning me. And I had a good friend of mine who was a lawyer. He was kind of representing me just in case. And he was shutting down this guy a lot of times, trying to ask him stupid questions.
Yeah.
And he said, well, okay, can you get drugs in most gyms in anywhere? I said, I suppose so. And then he caught me. And he goes, can you get him at Gold's Gym? I said, I suppose so.
Oh, or something like that.
And I trained at Gold's.
Oh, man.
And so not even thinking, inquiry was over for me. And back in the day, this was completely live all over the world.
Wow, you know, yeah.
And so I go back to the gym that day, and I park, and I walk up into the gym, and I see all these guys come out, and these are friends of mine. And believe it or not, all these guys were bouncers because they were personal friends, and I used to bounce for this big bar up the street, man. And they're all standing in front of the gym, and they're all like this with their hands crossed. I said, what are you doing, Steve? And I looked at them, and I said, and I knew right away what was happening. I said, guys, look, you know, I didn't mean to say Gold's Gym. Goes, it doesn't matter. You can't train here anymore.
Oh, man.
And I had to scramble to find a place.
Yeah.
I needed to train for a contest. I was devastated. And from that point on, my spirits and my training and everything, my training and stuff didn't suffer. But because my mind wasn't in the right place, I didn't prepare the way I should have.
Yeah.
And I was getting ready to do some really big things in 88 and 89. But hey,
you probably had a lot of friends at the gym and everything. And then,
So a friend of a friend had another place not too far. I mean, actually, it was pretty far in Toronto. I had to travel 40 minutes to get there every day and 40 minutes back. But
for those people that weren't around back then when this happened, this, you know, I remember because I had been in bodybuilding at that time. Steroids were never really talked about in the main media. I mean, athletes knew what steroids were, but like the general public didn't know anything about steroids.
No.
And I remember when Pumping Iron came out, everybody thought those guys just looked like that because they worked out. Nobody thought bodybuilders were on steroids or anything.
Right.
So when Ben Johnson got caught, this made newspaper headlines across the world. Steroids. And like you said, he was a muscular guy. So everybody associated muscles with steroids. And then that one incident blew open this whole steroid thing. So you said this, they had this national inquiry and it was all over. It was live, you know, like the OJ trial. And it was just a big, big deal.
It was a big deal. And they discovered obviously all this stuff going on in sports in Canada. And Canada wasn't the only place. Let's get it straight. I mean, let's Carl Lewis was taking this stuff too. Everybody knows that.
That's what I heard. Yeah,
and he just didn't get caught.
Yeah,
Ben, he was just, you know, I know what he got caught for. He got caught for Winstrol because I was on the same drug.
How do you think he got caught? Did he just not get off it in time, or
didn't get off it in time?
Yeah,
and he was probably taking some other oil based. As you know, Winstrol is water based, so it's in and out a lot quicker.
But the oil,
but I'm sure he was doing oil based stuff that I didn't know. But he got caught.
I saw a documentary or something, and he was saying they put it in his beer can or a Coke can or something, you know?
I was right there with him with our pants down. Right. Hot, man.
Right.
I've never seen Ben for a long time to this day, man. I still consider him a great person, but I want to be honest.
I think he was claiming that he was off it in time to pass the test, and then somebody – I think he might even say Carl Lewis or somebody, one of his competitors, sabotaged him by putting something in his Coke can or something.
What a cop out, man.
Yeah, yeah.
No, that was a hard part of my life and career because I had a lot of people I thought were my friends. And it was about 2 years later where all those guys started to come back and they understood everything was cool. You know, the truth was out there. And all I did was just say a couple of things in the stand and not meaning to say Gold's and all that, but
it's also the reason that Ben Weider decided to start the drug testing in 1990 with Olympia and the Arnold. And
but John, think about that. I was part of that first one.
Yeah, you were the first in the first drug tested world championships. Yeah.
Well, the Arnold Classic.
Oh, yeah, the Arnold Classic. Okay.
That was the first pro show that was drug. That was
tested. Yeah.
Tested. And
that was the one. Sean Ray failed the test.
Sean Ray failed, and Samir Banoud, I think.
Yeah. I think a few people failed.
Yeah. And at that time, I placed seventh, right?
Yes.
It was my first show, and I was John, believe it or not, I was drug-free for Arnold's for about 6 months.
Okay.
And I placed seventh in the contest. And
they said you got fifth.
Yeah, I got fifth. After those two guys got caught, I bumped up to fifth.
Oh, okay. Who got caught? Oh, Samir and Sean.
Samir and Sean were ahead of me, so.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I saw a caption of Sean Ray today on Instagram with him and Laura Crivell when they won that in 1990. He's like, sorry, Sean. Win officially.
Right.
But no, I ended up placing fifth. And it was really interesting because the next year I was invited back and I ended up placing sixth in the Arnold Classic. And in 90, 91 and 92, I ended up going back again and placing fifth again.
Now that Arnold was the Arnold was different than the World Championships you did because they didn't get the test back until after the show was over, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's why I got a call from Wayne D'Amelio, I don't know, a couple of weeks later or something like that, saying, I already heard from Bob Kennedy from Muscle Mag. And so he calls me up at home and I said, Wayne, good to hear from you, man. He goes, oh, I bet you know why I'm calling you. I said, oh yeah, man. My check.
Yeah. Yeah, I felt bad for Mike Ashley because he never got awarded on stage. You know,
that's right, because he won the contest free.
Yeah, right.
But yeah.
So how did they did the urine test for everybody, and then they just didn't get the results. They didn't do it in time to get the results before the show.
Exactly, they weren't prepared for that, which didn't make any sense. I mean, here we are in the universe in '86, we're able to do it in Tokyo.
Right, that's what doesn't make sense. 4 years later, they did it.
Yeah,
backwards. Right.
That was kind of bizarre how they did that. I think they thought maybe, I don't know, maybe I was under the impression nobody was going to get caught because they weren't going to do anything about it.
Yeah.
But you could tell that some of the guys that were used to doing the steroids were a little softer.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, John, I got harder.
Hmm.
My body adapted much better without them.
Yeah.
And that's why I was very careful in how I used them in the past, man. But
so you didn't use anything for 6 months before the show?
6 months before the contest.
Yeah. Okay.
And what happened though was a bit of a backlash with people complaining, and even the judges realized that, look, this is not going to work. So they just completely got out of the way, man.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. Thank you to Steve Brisbois for that great interview. We will be joined by Steve next week for part two of our interview, where we will continue to talk about his pro career, how he did in the Arnold Classic. And we're also going to talk about the unfortunate death of Momo Benaziza. Steve was there that night that Momo passed away, which was at one of the Grand Prix shows, which was right after the 1992 Mr. Olympia, which took place in Helsinki, Finland. So that'll be a great interview next week. And I want to thank our sponsor, Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our generous Patreon donors for sponsoring another episode. And you guys continue to support the show with your donations. I really appreciate you guys. If anyone out there wants to be a Patreon donor themselves and support the show, you can just go to our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. And look for the Patreon link, which is on the upper right-hand corner. All right. Before I let you guys go, I want to read this article, which comes from the August 1980 issue of Muscle and Fitness magazine, which used to be Muscle Builder. And I believe Joe Weider changed it in 1980, I think. And it was written by Frank Zane. And it says, training to win by fourth Olympia. So Frank, of course, was a three-time Mr. Olympia winner. And he was training for his fourth Olympia. This article came out in the summer. The contest was, I believe, in October 4th in Australia, Sydney, Australia. So Frank had won the contest in Columbus, Ohio for the last 3 years from 77 to 79. And now he was training to win his fourth one. And this was before that he learned that Arnold Schwarzenegger was going in the show. And it was also before Frank got into his unfortunate accident where he cut his urethra on the corner of the pool. All right. It says, back in the early part of 1979, I found myself faced with a dilemma.
On the one hand, I was in the midst of a promotional tour plugging our book, The Zane Way to a Beautiful Body, for Simon & Schuster. On the other, the Mr. Olympia was coming up in October, and I was sorely tempted to try for my third consecutive title. On the road constantly, I had been barely able to maintain a semblance of condition. Finally, with the Big O just 13 weeks away, I decided to enter the contest. Fortunately, when I made the decision, I was in reasonably hard condition, so I was able to go right into heavy training. I worked so hard that I injured my shoulder, but I won. That intense grind, however, taught me a lesson once and for all. The long, gradual buildup is best. Immediately following last week's win, I took a 2-week trip to Europe where I gave exhibitions and held seminars. Upon my return, I took things easy through November and December. This is the only time I seem to get to relax anymore. It was a semi-layoff, and I went to the gym only when I felt like it. Phase one was through January through March. I did not overextend myself in my training, and I was only moderately strict in my diet. But I was really pleased with my condition and the fact that I had added 7 pounds to the 190 that I weighed at the Olympia. Early in March, I returned to Europe for a series of exhibitions in Sweden and Denmark. It was a rough trip, and the weather was bad, but my endurance didn't give out until I was on the plane home. I took a few days off to recuperate, and then I started to train real light in phase two. In this phase, which went through the end of June, I trained with my wife, Christine. We went to the gym 3 days straight and then rested a day. The purpose of this 4-day cycle was to build up my strength and poundages and to gain body weight. There's a possibility that I'll weigh more than 200 pounds at this year's Olympia. With me, body weight isn't the goal. It's what the weight looks like. I have enough time to decide whether I want to be that heavy or whether I need to be that heavy, and whatever is most advantageous. It's all part of the strategy. I'm being honest when I say this, but there are many things I just don't know at this point. My training now has become almost purely instinctive. I can't say what I'm going to do when I go into the gym. I could write down a workout before I do it and find out that it did not turn out that way because I followed my instincts. I get all kinds of subliminal messages telling my body to go heavy or do an extra set or skip that exercise and do a new one. If you limit yourself to a planned workout, you miss a lot. My body knows better than I do what it needs and what it can accommodate. So it's a balance between pushing myself mentally and receiving feedback from my body as to what I should do. Christine and I trained together before the Olympia last year, and as we're training partners again as I prepare for Sydney. It's helped both of us a lot. She's strong, but she's doing higher reps because she finds that when she uses real heavy poundages, she gains body weight, and the higher reps make her streamlined. We do basically the same routine, the same number of sets, but different weights, of course. She doesn't do as much arm work as I do, but she will also do more stretching exercises. She also runs while I usually don't. Christine said, he's a little lazy. He gets up earlier than I do, so he thinks that's enough. I find myself waking up at about 4:30 every morning. Rather than lie there, I get up and go about my business. I eat a light breakfast soon after I awaken. Then I wake Christine, and we go to the gym at around 7 a.m. We train about 1.5 hours, and then we have breakfast. Right now, we're doing a total of 30 to 40 sets per workout, gradually increasing poundages. I feel sore after every workout, sometimes more than I want to be, so I know I'm hitting it the way I should. I used to do 100 sets per workout, and I wondered why I never grew. I was cut up all right, but not big. Now, however, I find that I'm doing less sets, and I'm putting more of an effort into each set. I get maximum returns. I like to do 3 to 4 sets with each exercise. I do more sets on the heavier exercises like the bench press, squat, and top deadlifts, which is from the knees up, the power lifts. Top deadlifts thicken the upper back. I do 6 to 8 sets on each power lift, increasing the weight each set. They are mass builders, so I feel that I should concentrate on them. I also do many sets of bent rows. The first day of the 4-day cycle, we work the back, biceps, forearms, and calves. The second day, we work the chest, shoulders, and triceps. The third day, it's thighs and calves. The fourth day is a rest day. I prefer the 4-day cycle because I can recuperate better. If you don't have rest days, you won't grow. Also, I have a lot of things in my life to do besides train, and the rest days make it possible for me to do them. I worked the 4-day cycle last summer until a month before the Olympia, and it was very effective. The final month, I trained every day with no time off for recuperation. With this long-term approach I'm using this year, I can see that at the end of each stage, I am much harder than I was at the end of the previous stage. I come out with more mass and body weight each time. I continue to log in my workout journal, writing everything down after each session. I've been making each 4-day cycle better than the previous one. Referring back, I find that I have used increased poundages in almost every workout. I believe I've been able to do this because the more frequent rest days. There are some days that I can't increase the poundages. On those occasions, I'll do an extra set. When I first started this program, I was doing only 20 sets total. I have found 20 sets the best for me when I resumed training after a long exhibition tour. Now, as I said, I'm doing 30 to 40 sets per workout, sometimes less on the heavy leg days. I work my midsection every day. I'm doing 3 sets on all exercises right now, concentrating on increasing the poundages. I will add an extra set here and there as time goes by. I'm working out in 3 different places, which could be the style of the 80s. There are many gyms, but there isn't one that has everything you want. My private gym in Palm Springs comes close to perfection, but I'm not always there. I manage to get a full 4-day cycle there at least every 2 weeks. At my own gym, I can do everything I want. When we were in Los Angeles, Christine and I work out at both the World Gym and a Nautilus Center. We work the upper body at World Gym and the legs at Nautilus. I may do squats at home in Santa Monica on my power rack there. I do calf raises on the Nautilus multi machine with Christine sitting on my back. This gives me a total of 370 pounds. I also do one-legged calf raises. I like the weight on the hips because it takes the pressure off the upper back. I've been doing a deep lunge squats, which are doing a lot for my leg biceps, especially the upper part. Then I do leg curls, leg extensions, and squats. I do some running, but not much. I like to run about 0.5 mile after each workout. If I can do that for 2 weeks, I can see a big difference in the quality of my muscle. Subcutaneous fat is reduced. But I will only run when I need it. And forget the 2 or 3 miles a day. I need size, not endurance. People who are able to run a lot are either small and lean or big with thick joints. I now weigh more than 200, but my joints really haven't gotten any thicker. Running can cause undue stress, all that weight crashing down on your feet. It's not worth it. I like the cardiorespiratory effect, but I can get that in other ways, through weight training, swimming, cycling, or running on a trampoline jogger. Incidentally, I think jogging in place on a trampoline is better than any of them, including running. Our plan is working very well for Christine and me, even though we have opposite problems. Since I'm the lean type, my goal is to develop more size. Christine, on the other hand, tends to gain weight easily and wants to stay lean. Before I go to the gym, I usually eat a light breakfast. I'll have a small baked yam, 4 ounces of cottage cheese, or a couple of soft-boiled eggs, and a small cup of espresso. I wait an hour before training. That small amount of food in my stomach makes for a much better workout. If I got out of bed in the morning and went right to the gym, I would get dizzy when I started training. My blood sugar is too low. The blood sugar level when you get up in the morning is normally around 90, but I need to hike my blood sugar level up to 140 to get the most out of my workout. I'm putting in many more hours of training this year than I did last. I don't have the business interruptions I did then, so now I can concentrate on my training. I'll give exhibitions in August at the Mr. Canada on August 16th and at George Schneider's Professional Miss Olympia on August 30th, which was the first Miss Olympia. Things are rapidly happening in women's bodybuilding. Schneider is offering $10,000 in prizes. It's not only definite that I'm entering the Olympia this year. I've even had my pre-Olympia dream. In the past, these dreams have never failed to assure me of winning. My dream this year had many signs pointing to victory. I'm not even thinking about any of the other competitors. I am strictly concentrating on my own training. The training right now is so satisfying. It's a payoff enough for me. During my Olympia buildup, I take a lot of vitamin and mineral supplements. I've been doing that for years, and this year is no exception. Right now, I'm taking supplements twice a day with meals. Each dose is 0.5 cup of capsules. But I don't take them all at once. I spread them out over a 2-hour period, monitoring my stomach to see that it doesn't get upset. I let the gelatin shell of the capsules dissolve in my mouth for about 30 seconds before I swallow them. It's much easier on my stomach that way. I'm not crazy about swallowing all those pills every day. It's a drag. You have to relax after taking them. You have to let them go through your system. You don't go running around or take a workout right afterwards. I know exactly how to take all these supplements because I've been doing it for so long. I take them in combinations. They work together, and I note the effect. But there are things that I have a special effect, and I use them for special purposes. For example, the amino acid tryptophan. If you're nervous or you're under a lot of stress during the day, it's good to take a gram maybe twice a day, or 2 or 3 grams before retiring. If I'm exhausted, I find that 5 grams will give me a deep sleep. Tryptophan doesn't work immediately like a drug, but its effects stay with you over a longer period of time. Until 4 years ago, I suffered with upper respiratory problems. One of the causes I learned was that my body couldn't assimilate all the milk products I was consuming. When I first started training, I thought you had to drink 8 quarts of milk a day to gain weight.
We didn't know about Weider's Olympian crash weight gain formula number 7, heavy training, or protein powders at the time. I was also doing some experimenting with vitamin C then, and I began taking more and more C every day. I was teaching school at the time, and the regular breaks during the day were reminders to take the vitamin. Over a period of 2 months, I gradually increased my vitamin C intake to 25 grams a day, which is 25,000 milligrams. I continued this intake for about 3 months. Since then, I have rarely been troubled with upper respiratory problems. Another point, in my training, I've observed that it's not when you're training hard and dieting that you look your best. That point comes after you have laid off for a few days. I call this phenomenon the latency effect. As much as 2 weeks after you've laid off, you can still look terrific, even better than you did when you were training. People don't realize that. I see guys in the gym working their entire body the day before a show, only to peak 3 days after the show. Why not alter that situation? Why not push your training up a bit so that you peak on the day of the show? Of course, everybody's different, so the timing's an individual matter. This latency effect also applies to strength training. Several days rest after heavy training causes your strength to increase and eliminates chronic fatigue. Diets and vitamins also seem to work this way. When I'm taking loads of supplements, like during the 2 week period before a show, I don't see what I want to see in my body. But when I stop for a few days, then I see it. It takes a while for assimilation to take place before the refinements finally come out. I've noticed that it works in reverse too. The point was brought home to me years ago by an ex-training partner. Returning from a trip to Europe, he bragged about how flagrantly he had cheated on his diet there. Candy bars, ice cream, wine, beer. He'd eaten and drunk all day long. And he did stay in great shape for 2 weeks. After that, he ballooned, suddenly gaining 20 pounds. It's like the proverbial snowball rolling downhill. It starts out small and it gradually builds into an avalanche. A person 50 pounds overweight has a difficult time losing weight at first. When the patterns and habits of diet and exercise get established, the weight loss gains momentum and the pounds come off rapidly. The same latency effect prevails whether you're building muscle or losing fat. A champion bodybuilder has to learn how to utilize this effect. I would never go for an absolute peak more than once a year. When I guest pose at the Zanes Women Invitational, which will be history by the time this appears in print, I will look better than I did at the last Olympia. But that still won't be anything compared to how I'll look for the Olympia in August. It'll be something totally new, and there will be enough time to do it. As I've said, I've never trained as long for a show before. In the past, I tried to do too much at the last moment. I'll have my homework done this year. I won't have to worry about all my gains coming in the last 3 months before the contest. It's comforting to know that my gains this year will have come gradually and reliably over a 10-month period. All right, the end. Good article by Frank Zane. Frank always wrote these really great articles. They're always very insightful. I always like how he learned so much about his physique every contest he did. He was always learning, and it was all about nutrition and supplements and training, which, as we've talked about on the podcast recently, is a big difference from the way bodybuilding is today, which it seems like it's more about drugs, where back then it was more about the hard work and the training and the diet. And Frank was an expert at really learning what worked for his body. But unfortunately, that year did not go well because of that accident. And I think if Frank could do it all over again, he probably would have skipped the 1980 Mr. Olympia and just competed in 1981, where he would have been up against Franco at the 1981 Olympia in Columbus, Ohio. So that would have been really interesting if it would have turned out that way. All right, guys, that's all we got for this week's show. I hope you enjoyed it. We will be back next week. So stay safe out there. Keep training hard, and we'll see you guys next week. Take care.